Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. You were born in 1924 when Calvin Coolidge was president. After a few months of college, you joined the Army Air Corps during World War II, flying night reconnaissance over Nazi Germany in the Battle of the Bulge. The war over, you earn a law degree, get married, and raise a family. You practice law for more than half a century. What have you learned along the way? Bob Anderson, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
My pleasure.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Well, I never knew a father. My mother, she was the youngest of five children. Her family came over from the Hawaiian Islands. And she, the youngest of the five children, took care of me as well as her parents.
You say you never knew your father. Did he die, leave the family?
I don't know. It seemed to be a discussion that wasn't pleasant to my mother, so I didn't probe.
I see.
I felt that I had an absolutely wonderful childhood. I was raised in San Leandro, which is a small community down the bay from San Francisco, so to speak. My grandfather raised chickens. My mother became... she had a succession of jobs. She eventually was executive secretary of the East Bay Safety Council, which is a community organization. She became prominent in her field. She did, I always felt that I was kind of a rich kid. I lived in an area that was on the other side of two sets of tracks, the Western Pacific and then the Southern Pacific. It was an agrarian community, and where we lived, lots of Portuguese, Spanish, not Mexican people, Spanish, and Italians.
What made you feel rich? It sounds like your mom raising the family alone and wasn't having hugely remunerative jobs.
Well, we had, my mother had a car. We had a telephone. There was one other telephone in the area right there within a couple blocks. Our house, which my mother funded, my grandfather had bought the land and had built a house, a two-story house. Subsequently, when I was about four or so, my mother arranged for a two-bedroom, I'd say the nicest house in our block or so.
It sounds like she had a major influence over your life.
Oh, absolutely.
What was it? How would you describe it?
Well, she took such great care of me. I was an only child. Looking back, I think I was a spoiled kid. I think I probably, I can't say I prevented her remarrying. When gentlemen would come to call, I'd go out in the yard. And anyway, I hate to think of what a stinker I was.
You went out in the yard and did what?
Oh,
raised
stayed out of the way.
Oh, I
no,
see.
I didn't break any windows or anything.
Okay, it sounds like you might be saying you made an impression that on the
I
suitor.
Think she got the idea that I didn't appreciate men calling on her.
Huh. Okay, so now as you look back, and you just said looking back, what did you learn from her?
Well, you can't do it all over again. I think that I was very fond of my grandparents, and they of me. Neither of them ever laid a hand on me. My mother administered the discipline, scant as it was. Much more was needed. Well, life is a series of educational events, but unfortunately, you have to do it looking over your shoulder.
All right. What did you learn from her? Did she teach you those lessons? Or did you learn something different from her, your experience with her?
Well, it's pretty hard to separate. My grandmother was illiterate. My grandfather had essentially taught himself to read. He was a major... a moral force in looking at things. I never heard him use profanity at all.
Mm-hmm.
I never... he He didn't have alcohol around the house. He didn't smoke. My grandmother was a major force in seeing that I went to Sunday school.
Okay.
And which I did until I was probably a good 16.
And are you still religious?
Very much so. Of course, the path that I've been fortunate to follow has only buttressed my belief that this isn't all there is to it.
Sounds like you had very strong grandparents. I'll go back to your mother. What did you learn from her?
She taught me how to handle my life.
That's a big statement.
Well, it worked. Bobby, don't cry, that sort of thing.
Meaning?
Soldiers don't cry. I did. Well, maybe. Not much, anyway.
And your public schooling, what, if any, impact did that have on you?
Well, I went to Lincoln Grammar School, which, though the tracks weren't near it, it was on the other side of the best part of San Leandro, so to speak. East 14th Street divided the area. And the population of Lincoln Grammar School was polyglot, Portuguese, Spanish, mm-hmm. etc. And in grammar school, I found that I had leadership ability.
What does that mean to you, leadership ability?
Well, I could kind of call the shots. We had a junior traffic reserve, and I started out as a sergeant and ended up as captain.
Feeling leadership ability at a young age is a pretty unusual quality. Did that continue in high school?
Well, it did. I took interest in classroom activities. I ran for office, that sort of thing. I cultivated those around me that would support me. I held various class offices, mm-hmm. and then on to high school, junior high school, and high school was in the same place in that community, but definitely on the best side of town.
In a word, did that leadership experience, that cumulative leader experience, influence your future life?
Well, ultimately it did. It is a matter of giving you self-confidence.
I mentioned in the introduction you were in college for a few months before joining the Army Air Corps. Why only a couple of months?
Well, I had worked toward college education. It was always my understanding, I'm going to go to college. And I always felt, whatever, my mother would be right there making doggone sure I was able to go to college. I worked toward that in my high school career, so to speak. I did pretty well scholastically. I ended up second in my class graduating. I became student body president. Ultimately, I'd been chief justice of the student court, that sort of stuff. I lost a few elections, but the ones that I wanted, I got.
Why only a couple of months in college?
I did go to University of California at Berkeley. I had a scholarship, which my mother helped me get, through the Alumni Association. Why only a couple months? Because my graduation was January of 1942.
Your high school graduation?
Yes, my high school graduation was
January
of 1942. Pearl Harbor had occurred a couple of months before that. Classes had already started at the university. I went to work in the shipyards, started college, and then enlisted in December. So I was in college, say, between August and December.
Why did you enlist?
Well, I wanted to go. I was always very interested in the military. In fact, I tried to get an ROTC unit in my high school, but that wasn't available. I went to CMTC. In those days, that was a government program. It was a civilian kind of civilian military training camps. Mm-hmm. If you went there for 4 years and took courses, you became a second lieutenant. I aspired to the military.
Why the Air Corps?
Well, as a kid on a bicycle, I would go down to the Oakland Airport and hang on the fence and watch the airplanes flying around. And there was a military unit that was a Naval Reserve unit. And they'd see me hanging out there, and they'd invite the kid in to climb up and look in the cockpit. I thought flying would be great.
So you were attracted to airplanes. You had early military training in high school. How did that play out in terms of your advancement and getting what you wanted in military service?
I felt comfortable as a member of the armed forces because of the experiences I had had before. It just made it easier for me to get along with the system.
And how about flying an airplane? I mean, it's one thing to look at an airplane as a kid. It's another thing to fly one.
Well, it was a challenge, but it was lots of fun to do. I certainly didn't think, in terms of those days, you spoke of people who were, he's a hot pilot. I wasn't a hot pilot. I was a very cautious pilot. I crashed in an AT-6 training plane in Arizona in my basic flight training, and then when I got to advanced, I crashed once again.
What does the Air Force decide if you crash twice?
The first time, they came to my hospital bed and asked, do you still want to fly, mister? And I said, yes, sir. The second time, that's the first time I ever saw a court reporter, because they had a hearing, which I got all dressed up for and shined the shoes and all that sort of thing. There was a formal hearing. A full investigation was done of the aircraft where they found it. In due course of events, I was okay to just keep on going. The major who was in charge took me aside and said, mister, I know you effed up, but I can't prove it. And so I kept going.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with World War II Air Force veteran and attorney Bob Anderson. A young person of the generation of the Depression typically didn't travel a lot. I'm assuming in the Air Force you traveled a lot. Fair?
Oh, indeed. That's correct. And the Depression, you got that right. People just didn't go places.
Sure.
And I'd never been more than 100 miles from where I lived until I got into the armed forces.
How was that? I'm talking about, let's say, pre-Europe. Traveling across different parts of the United States, meeting more people, change your perspective on anything?
Well, it certainly broadened the perspective I had. Meeting people, more interestingly, or people in the South that I'd come up with. They were great fighters. I'd never seen segregation, anything like what I saw where I trained.
Okay, you trained in segregated America.
Yes, I did.
How did it strike you?
Well, it seemed really unfair, but in another respect, in San Leandro, where I grew up, we did not have African Americans in our school system. They were in Oakland, and we competed against them as athletes, but Negroes didn't live in San Leandro. I only found out after the war how that worked.
That was de facto segregation of housing.
That's right. They had restrictive covenants that didn't run with the land. It was just by word. Black people were not welcome.
And the military service itself was segregated during the Second World War.
It was until Mr. Truman, after the war, broke it down.
From our earlier discussions, I understand you arrived in Europe at a very strategic time, the fall of 1944, shortly before the Germans launched their last major attempt at an offensive called the Battle of the Bulge, correct?
That's correct.
What were your responsibilities?
Oh, I was a part of a group containing four different flights of our squadron. Our type of work was unique. It was experimental. We flew the Douglas A-20 aircraft, which was a low-level attack bomber that had been modified so that we could drop flash bombs, generally from around 11,000 to 13,000 feet. My navigator, utilizing a British navigation set of instruments called G, he would put me right over the target. It was amazing what George could do. Then tell me we're on target now. Then I would open the bomb bay doors and punch off the bombs one at a time.
What's the point of a flash bomb?
The flash bomb would be fused to explode about 2,500 feet above ground. A photoelectric cell would be activated, it would expose the film in the camera, which was in the aft portion of the ship, looked over by my observer.
All right, so that information then is key intelligence information for potential military response by the American forces or the Allies.
The purpose of this was to be in close support of the Army. General Patton was moving very fast through France to get to the Germans, and we would be asked to go over a particular marshaling yard, that's words for where trains were made up, go over where bridges were, where important intersections were, to see what activity was taking place, if any, at night. We fly back to our base. The films are immediately looked at. The photo interpreter sees what he's able to see. There's a fighter-bomber squadron across the strip from us.
Okay, and that guides military action. Yeah, yeah. That's vital information.
Well, the next morning, the P-47s are off looking for the target.
If I understand this process, you're flying a plane at 2+ miles elevation in a reasonably straight line, dropping lights, exploding bombs. What about anti-aircraft? You're sort of setting yourself up to get shot down, it seems to me.
We considered that what you've just said was just the way it was liable to work. I never drew ground fire, but there were searchlight activity frequently, and we knew that their searchlights were attached to anti-aircraft guns.
Why do you think they didn't shoot?
We got the impression that they didn't want to waste stuff on just one single aircraft. They didn't know what the heck was happening.
Interesting.
What we did have was another type of device invented by Harold E. Edgerton, known as Doc Edgerton. Those who are familiar with the famous photograph of drops in milk splashing back, he invented that kind of system, but that involved our generating our own light from the aircraft and taking continuous pictures, but at no more than 2,500 or 3,000 feet above ground, and that was just like towing a Coca-Cola sign, and we felt that little kids could throw rocks at you. That's bad news.
How many missions?
I only had one Edgerton mission, so-called. The others were, I had one mission. Well, I went and flew as an observer before I took my crew up.
And in the combined reconnaissance methods, how many missions did you fly?
19 missions as a pilot.
Suggesting you flew
up one missions? As an observer before I took my crew up to see what it was going to be like.
What was your sense, other than the day-to-day tensions and realities of flying, of the war itself? Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, what did that mean, if anything, to you?
Well, those days, of course, before television, we always watched the news reels intently at the movie house. And there was no question that Mr. Hitler had laid a course that he was going to follow. And when Pearl Harbor came, we had to do what we had to do.
Did you have any what I would call philosophical understanding of fascism or Nazism as a variant, or imperialism, Japanese style, or was that not relevant to what you felt your duty was to your country?
Well, it really was a matter of duty to the country, and that it wouldn't be long before the two oceans, one on either side, would have been, look what happened at Pearl Harbor. That was a tremendous shock. How dare the Japanese do this? Heck, I had no qualms about doing what I had to do, and I felt that after the war, when I get married and have a family and so on, my first grandchild said one day in the fourth grade, "Grandpa, did you ever kill anybody?" And I said, "Michael, no, I didn't, but I would have if I had to."
World War II ended about 71 years ago. You've had a lot of time to look back on your experience. What do you take away from it? What are you left with? What feelings?
Well, it was a very significant part of my life. I'm sorry for, of course, things that happened. We lost guys in our outfit. A lot of it was due to bad weather. Some of it was due to our own night fighters. But it was a great adventure that I was allowed to experience.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Bob Anderson, Army Air Corps veteran and longtime attorney at law. Why law?
Well, because I think I've envisioned such a thing when I was even in grammar school.
Really?
It's part of being able to stand up and speak to the class about something or other, telling people what to do about the junior traffic reserve, subsequently in high school, in managing events. I went to Boys State through the American Legion, that sort of thing. Law was, that's what I wanted to do. But I wanted to be on the prosecution side.
You related the earlier experiences to experiencing leadership. Do you regard the law as a leadership position in society?
Certainly.
Why?
We all got to get together, and if we don't organize accordingly, it goes all the way back to what you hear about saluting the flag and what the rules are.
Without rules,
and lawyers
what?
Have to play an integral part of that.
Meaning rules are important from your standpoint.
Of course.
Someone might say there are rules and there are rules. There are rules made from dictatorial kings, which in the case of King George we overthrew as a nation and founded our nation. There are rules that are formed through some democratic process. Does the nature of the rules matter from your perspective?
Of course, it's not just automatic. The rules that our founding fathers found, we can't handle the rules that George is putting down on us, so we'll have to change the rules.
Where'd you go to law school?
Hastings College of the Law, that was then located in San Francisco. It's now a much bigger institution. It was the first law school west of the Mississippi.
What did you learn in law school that you didn't know that was important looking back?
That I didn't know?
That you didn't know going into law school, that you learned in law school, that do you really feel is important?
Well, law school was just like the getting that far in the educational process before I got there. Just about learning new rules, learning new techniques. Law school's a lot different today than it used to be. We didn't have practical touches.
Okay. But you practiced 50-plus years in the practical world. What was that like as an experience? What did you learn from that experience?
Well, it was a matter of being able to handle the rules that I knew that's the way the system worked, and I was good at it.
What was your specialty?
I was a trial lawyer, and the specialty field was in representing physicians and hospitals in what are called malpractice cases. I was on the defense side and had the good fortune to have such good people that came to work with me. We ended up being very well regarded in the legal profession.
The legal system is adversarial in this country. Both sides have attorneys. The assumption being that through that adversarial process, the jury or the judge hears both sides and is best able to make a fair decision. Was that your experience in your medical malpractice specialized field?
The way you phrase it, yes, that's idealized to an extent because times change. There were times in my early practice where those on the plaintiff side, the ex-patient who has a grief to bear, and it was difficult for the plaintiff's attorneys to get other doctors, to get doctors to testify against the doctor. Well, that's changed.
Let me just ask if I heard you correctly. There was a period of time where doctors would not go into court commonly to testify against another doctor and said he screwed up.
I would say that it was difficult for a plaintiff's attorney to obtain a witness to testify on behalf of his client that the standard of practice had been violated as a result of which an injury had occurred to the patient.
Okay.
Due to the negligence of the physician in his or her failure to follow the standard
of care.
Now,
why would you say that was difficult? Because you lived through that. Was it sort of a good old boys club? Or did it? And then also, did it? It's obviously changed.
I think you'd best direct that to members of the medical profession.
Okay, and
who are going to be old enough to remember that? And
that's a while ago.
And that's not much of a problem today. I don't see that as any problem in getting medical testimony from people in the highest positions in teaching medicine and in practicing medicine.
So the implication of that to me as a citizen would be the playing field has changed.
Indeed.
How do you feel about that?
It was all to the good, of course.
You've indicated medical malpractice has improved in terms of the quality of justice, it seems to me, listening to you. Do you have any thoughts about how our overall legal system is working? Any significant changes?
Well, more as a general citizen who reads, it's tough. Our 99% and 1% that's brooded about, I think that the little guy has a tough row to hoe.
And it's expensive to litigate?
Yes, it is. It is.
And is that taken advantage of by the people with resources?
I can only say just as this. Not that I have seen this kind of thing, but it's obvious that that's what's going on.
You've obviously had a distinguished career. You were an honorable veteran of World War II, and you were an outstanding attorney, and you're a citizen of the United States. How do you feel about the country now?
Well, I'm not going to agree to the terms that you use
about
me.
You're modest, that's fair enough.
As a citizen of the country, I've been so fortunate to have been born in these United States, and we do have a great future, but I've never seen things so fouled up as they are right now, with the potential of our succumbing to finger-pointing and being even more divisive than our past history would show. I think we're going to make it, but people are going to have to work at it.
Work at what? What do they have to do?
Work at getting along with other people, different societies. It's a big world, but it's getting smaller all the time. We're going to make it. All in all, I'd sure like to say that I don't know how come I've been so lucky, but I've sure had a great ride.
Bob Anderson, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.